I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday Health Watch. The Affordable Care Act may have survived last week's repeal and replace effort in the House of Representatives, but experts say Obamacare could still be undermined by its foes in Congress and in the Trump administration, who predicted it's doomed to implode. Could health services covered under the law still be at risk? And in Annapolis, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan and lawmakers in the General Assembly are moving to intensify the fight against the epidemic of heroin and opioid abuse across the state and to support expanded treatment, recovery, and enforcement programs. Today on the Midday Health Watch, Dr. Lena Wen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City, joins me to talk about these and other issues on the front lines of public health. We'll take your calls, your questions, and your comments. The Midday Health Watch gets underway right after this hour's headlines. And good afternoon, everybody. So glad you are with us today on Midday for the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. In a dramatic political showdown last week, the Republican-led House and a determined President Trump tried but failed to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Speaker Paul Ryan's decision to withdraw his controversial bill because of defections by both conservative and moderate Republicans means the ACA remains the law of the land. But with opponents still vowing to bring the program down, are critical medical coverage and public health services still in jeopardy? Concerns were also raised this month by the Trump administration's proposed 2018 budget, which would boost defense spending and sharply reduce funding to federal agencies like Health and Human Services, whose budget would be slashed by 18%. What would those cuts mean for the future of medical research, maternal health care, and addiction treatment? Here in Maryland, Governor Larry Hogan's declaration earlier this month of a state of emergency provides an extra $50 million over the next 5 years to combat heroin and opioid abuse and to help support the state's prevention, recovery, and enforcement efforts. Today, it's another edition of the Midday Health Watch, our monthly visit with Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. We'll talk about the ACDA going forward and the continuing campaign against the opioid epidemic. You are welcome to join us with your questions and comments for Dr. Wen, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Lena, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you, Tom. Thank you.
And you announced on Twitter and on our show the last time you were here that you're pregnant, you're expecting a child. You look great. How you feeling? How's it going so far?
I feel well. I am tired. I drink a lot of water. Mm-hmm. I feel myself expanding on a daily basis. I'm learning all the joys of pregnancy. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot as my pregnancy coincides with the ACA and the replacement proposals. I've been thinking about how lucky I am. I have excellent prenatal care. I have great insurance. When my doctor says you should come in and get an ultrasound, come in for an office visit, come in for these blood tests, I don't think about the trade-off of how much would it cost if I didn't have insurance. And I actually looked into the cost. For an ultrasound without insurance, it costs up to $250.
Yeah.
With an office visit, $400. A pap smear, over $50. Blood test, $300. I mean, these costs really add up.
And maternal care was included under this list of so-called essential benefits that was one of the sticking points in this bill. There were conservatives who said that the Ryan bill or the Trump bill, whatever you want to call it, should not include these essential benefits. Maternal care is certainly a big part of that package, wasn't it?
That's right, which is extremely concerning. I mean, this does not only punish the current generation, it punishes future generations as well. Studies, for example, have found that women who don't receive prenatal care are 5 times more likely to have an infant who dies than a woman who does receive prenatal care. And we are making these trade-offs that actually don't make fiscal sense. Investing in prenatal care also saves money down the line. We can save the cost of a child who could be born with birth defects if the mom had better care. And these are the things that really concern me about the ACA replacement, that we have this narrative of choice of, well, women choose to be pregnant, and so they can choose to not have benefits if they want to, or somebody else doesn't want to get pregnant, so they shouldn't choose to have benefits. But we also have to remember that nearly one in two pregnancies in the U.S. today are unintended pregnancies. And especially since the replacement plan also was going to take away reproductive health options. What kind of choice is that? I mean, choice is predicated on privilege. And those of us who are privileged, including myself, we're very lucky to have the choices that we do. But we need to think about how can we level the playing field for everyone and ensure that we improve the health and well-being of all of our residents.
Let's listen to a little montage of first Speaker Paul Ryan talking about the ACA and its status at the moment, then President Trump, and then Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Obamacare is the law of the land. It's going to remain the law of the land until it's replaced. We did not have quite the votes to replace this law. And so, we're going to be living with Obamacare for the foreseeable future. I don't know how long it's going to take us to replace this law. My worry is Obamacare is going to be getting even worse.
I've been saying for the last year and a half that the best thing we can do, politically speaking, is let Obamacare explode. It is exploding right now.
It is deeply wrong for the president of the United States, whose one and only job is to look out for the American people, to root for the failure of our country's health care system. It is deeply wrong for the President of the United States to announce that he is going to drag down our entire health care sector, a sector that accounts for more than one-sixth of the entire U.S. economy, just so he can stand on top of the wreckage and waggle his fingers and say, I told you so.
So to Senator Warren's point, does this become something of a self-fulfilling prophecy? I mean, we've got Mr. Ryan, Mr. Trump, and many others just repeating time after time after time that the Obamacare legislation is going to die of its own. It's going to asphyxiate by itself. Mm-hmm. And they get this information from people in the insurance companies. I mean, the CEO of Aetna Insurance told the Wall Street Journal that Obamacare was in a death spiral. Humana, the big insurer, said that last month that it would exit all of the exchanges in 2018. Cigna not planning to expand its ACA business this year. I mean, there are people dropping out, companies choosing to drop out of the exchanges because they're not making enough money and they can't afford to insure people. So what does one make of this? Because then on the other hand, you got an awful lot of people who are quite clearly happy with the care they're getting under the ACA. But the country still is kind of divided. The Kaiser polling most recently shows about half the country for it and half the country against it. It's now starting to tip a little bit more for it than against it. But how do we make sense of all this?
Sure, although I'll first say that there is huge misunderstanding about the quote-unquote Obamacare. I mean, the same polls also show that people don't support Obamacare but support the Affordable Care Act, which obviously are the same thing. So there's a lot of misunderstanding. And I actually think that the recent debates about the replacement for the ACA have helped Americans gain a better understanding of what it is that ACA has done, about how many people, for example, have been affected by Medicaid expansion, how many vulnerable individuals, including women, children, seniors, individuals with disabilities, would be hugely impacted, and how millions of lives could be at stake if the replacement plan had gone through. So I think there are two separate things to talk about. The first is the fact that the replacement plan failed and that the ACA, as has been mentioned, is the law of the land. Now, I'm very glad that the replacement plan did not go through. It's remarkable when you have physician groups, patient advocacy groups, nurses groups, public health groups, insurers, all stand united to say that the passage of that of the bill to replace the ACA will really hurt the health and well-being of millions of Americans, and in particular affect those who are the most vulnerable. The greatest premium increase, for example, is estimated to be for low-income older adults. I mean, these are the individuals that we're punishing. So I'm glad that the replacement plan did not go through. That said, the second issue is that just because it didn't go through doesn't mean that we should all take a sigh of relief and say, well, in that case, we don't have any problems because the implementation of the law really still depends on President Trump and what his administration under Secretary Price decide to do. It is true that they can. They have the ability to make the markets explode. They have the ability to not subsidize insurance companies and not encourage for young, healthy people to invest in healthcare. If they don't, then premiums are going to increase for everyone and we're going to have insurers drop out. And so I think the key at this point is for the president and for our elected officials to decide what it is that is the most important to them. Do they want to make a point for political reasons, or do they want to improve the health and well-being of the residents, of the people that they're serving? Obviously, as a physician, as a public health official, I believe that our ultimate goal is to improve health and well-being. It's also the fiscally responsible thing to do. And if we really care about national security, we need to talk about preparing and guarding against disasters and really ensuring that we're protected against diseases and outbreaks.
And of course, the president has made, you know, he won the election in part because he was opposed to Obamacare. He has already directed the IRS not to enforce the requirement that you have health insurance. So he's taking away the penalty for young people or anybody to who decide not to insure themselves. So they will go uninsured. But they don't pay a penalty now. There were reports that he withdrew money that was going to be spent advertising the open enrollment period so that he's not going to be doing anything to proactively encourage people to sign up for health insurance. So he does have a very direct capacity to affect the size of the pool of people who are being insured. And the pool really seems to be key to this whole thing. When people talk about tweaking Obamacare and making it better, it comes down to creating enough people who don't need health care in the immediate future who are willing to be insured in case they confront a catastrophic situation or you know, they confront whatever situations they might confront. Is there any data, I wonder, about young people in healthcare? If you're in your 20s, you're 30s, you're healthy, you're working out, you feel great, as one is want to do in their 20s and 30s, is there anything that we know scientifically outside of the political realm that serves as a great incentive to an individual like that to be sure that she is insured?
Well, there are three things. The first is that nobody plans to be sick. Nobody plans to get in a car accident and break their leg. Nobody plans to be diagnosed with cancer. Nobody plans for these catastrophic life events, but they happen to us and we need to be prepared. The second thing is that it's important to invest in prevention because if we don't get our regular checkups, if we don't get our screenings done, then we're likely to be much more ill down the line. The third thing is that for young people and for all of us, we have to understand the concept of insurance, which is that you do need a large enough pool for us for costs to decrease. And I'd say to young people who are not sure if they're going to get health insurance is first, you need to protect yourself if something bad happens. Second, you need to prevent other problems from occurring. So this is an investment in yourself. But third, this is an investment in our society. I believe that we have an obligation to each other. We have an obligation to other members of our community. And this is the investment that we have to make so that we don't just have costly care down the line that all of us have to pay for eventually anyway. We're all taxpayers. We will end up paying for it anyway. Why not pay for less upfront and ensure that people are healthier at the end of the day? And I want to respond to your other point, Tom, too, about what it is that people elected President Trump to do. When we look at the maps, again, scientific data, not politics. So when we look at the maps of who are the people who voted for President Trump, those maps also correspond almost entirely, if not entirely, to the areas that are the hardest hit by the opioid epidemic. These are the same areas that are faced with disinvestment and unemployment, where people are wondering, how is my tomorrow going to be better than today? These are the areas that are going to be punished the most if the ACA is repealed, because one in four people who are receiving treatment for substance use disorders are on Medicaid. Many millions of people could potentially see their coverage being taken away overnight. And for these individuals, there's no margin of error. They're going to overdose and die. And so if President Trump is to fulfill his campaign promise to address the public health emergency of addiction, then he also needs to expand healthcare access and, in fact, do even more to make the ACA work rather than let it implode or even make it explode.
And, of course, we'll remind folks that the bill that Congressman Ryan withdrew before a vote, the American Health Care Act, AHCA, as opposed to ACA, the Affordable Care Act, would have dramatically cut Medicaid. And that's, as you mentioned, that's the program that is helping an awful lot of people who are dealing with substance abuse issues.
And essential health benefits as well. Cutting out essential health, cutting out the requirement for essential health benefits would have also cut out the requirement for insurance companies to provide addiction and mental health treatment, which seems unconscionable. And medically speaking, is unreasonable and just wrong. I mean, we should treat mental health with the same urgency and compassion as we treat physical health.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, she is the Baltimore City Health Commissioner. She's here for our monthly Midday Health Watch. We're going to take a short break right now. When we come back, we'd love to hear from you at 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. More on healthcare, the ACA, the AHCA. We'll also talk about some things going on regarding opioid and substance abuse here in Maryland. There's some bills pending in the General Assembly. We'll talk about a couple of other things as well. 410-662-8780. Join our conversation when we come back from a break. We'll be right back.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, my guest will be Alec Ross. He's a leading innovation expert and the author of The Industries of the Future. We'll talk about the advances and challenges that may emerge in global industries over the next 10 years or so and what it will take to navigate them successfully. That's tomorrow on Midday. Alec Ross will also be a keynote speaker at the EduLab at Light City Symposium next week. The Light City Baltimore Festival gets underway on Friday. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday Health Watch with my guest, Dr. Lena Nguyen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's talk about Governor Hogan and his efforts to increase allocation of resources to fight this opioid epidemic. We've been talking about this for months now. It's not getting any better. We have certainly not seen the chart start to drift southward. It is still drifting northward. Here's a clip of the governor with a few things to say about this problem.
The reality is that this threat has rapidly escalated with the introduction of fentanyl, which is 100 times more powerful and is far more deadly. Heroin use has tripled nationwide in the past 12 months. There are now estimated to be 27 million heroin users across the country. Heroin and opioid-related deaths have doubled in the last year in our state.
So this is a few months ago, the governor was saying that the deaths have doubled in our state, but that it's gotten even worse since he made those remarks. The fact that he's declared a state of emergency, what does that mean for the city of Baltimore and your efforts to combat this epidemic?
I fully applaud Governor Hogan's efforts in combating the opioid epidemic and calling it as the public health emergency that it is. We know that addiction is a disease. We know that we can save lives. We know that treatment works, recovery is possible, and that treating individuals with addiction as criminals, as people who made a bad choice, just is not going to work and, frankly, is inhumane when there are actually treatment options that are available and millions of people around the country who are successfully in long-term recovery. Now, when I started in my job in January of 2015, I also declared at that time of the city addiction, opioid overdose to be a public health emergency. And we have rapidly increased our efforts to get naloxone or Narcan into the hands of every resident. To date, we have saved over 800 residents in our city. And these are not just by, I'm not counting the numbers saved by paramedics and police officers and doctors, but it's 800 or so neighbors who have saved other neighbors.
And these are people who are literally at death's door. They would have overdosed and died had they not had a dose of naloxone administered.
They are individuals who were seconds away from dying. But because they got this life-saving medication, this antidote, Narcan or naloxone, they are now alive today and are able to get into treatment and have full lives with their families and contribute to society. So Governor Hogan is right to declare the state of emergency across the state. And we will look forward to working with him and with our other state partners and partners across our jurisdictions in the state to increase treatment at the time that people need it. Naloxone is really important because we have to save people's life right now. Otherwise, if they die right now, there's no chance for them to get into treatment tomorrow. But we also need to ensure that people with addiction can get the help that they need when they need it. So getting to treatment on demand, we're nowhere near that. So we've been working also with the Senate president, with President Miller, with Delegate Bromwell, and many of our state legislators on getting through a package of opioid legislation that is currently in the Senate that looks at things like how can we fund 24/7 behavioral health ER so that people can walk in and get treatment the same way that they would if they had a heart attack or a stroke. We're also looking at increased prevention, increased stroke screening, expansion of treatment options like buprenorphine, which is one of the evidence-based medications. And I think that the package of legislation through this HOPE Act will be an excellent complement to the governor's declaration of state of emergency, because you have the declaration, but it's also helpful to see specific action items that are being outlined in the legislature that we then on the local level are able to implement.
And Rachel Bay, our State House reporter, gives us an update today. As you mentioned, Senator Miller very much behind this HOPE Act. That's friends in high places for that bill. So it has not passed yet, but it does seem that the prognosis for this bill, the prospects for the bill are pretty good, passing the legislature. There's some other bills that are in front of the assembly these days. One of them puts limits on prescribers. And you and I have talked about this before, that physicians are thought to, in some cases, to be prescribing opioids a little too liberally and getting people hooked. And then they move from opioids, OxyContin and that kind of stuff, to heroin because heroin's cheaper once they get addicted to the opioids. That evidently has not made it quite out of committee yet, so they're still talking about that. And there's another bill that has passed the Senate. It's in the House, but it's also not gotten out of the House committee, and that stiffens criminal penalties for people who are distributing opioids and heroin. So, I mean, there's a whole laundry list of things that the governor wants to do. The $50 million over 5 years. Give us an example of the kind of programs, how that money would be allocated here in Baltimore City.
Sure. I'll respond to the first part of what you mentioned, too, which is that there's no question that addressing this epidemic will require many players, many components, many strategies. It's important, though, for us in general to take a public health approach, which is to say that further criminalizing individuals with a disease is not going to work. And in fact, will only worsen ongoing disparities. It is communities of color. It is low-income communities that have traditionally been the victims of overdose and addiction, but also have experienced serious criminal penalties that have adversely affected entire communities and generations. And so for us to take the approach of, look, we know what works. There is plenty of science, hundreds of studies to show what works when it comes to addiction treatment. We just need the funding to be able to get there.
Right. And I do think that the governor's bill targets the people who sell the drugs, meaning if a person gets a substance and it results in his or her death, the person that person got the drugs from would be subject to this, to increase criminal penalty.
There are two concerns in the public health community about that. The first is that the majority of people who are distributing drugs on the street are subsistence drug dealers.
So they are themselves.
They themselves have a substance use disorder. They themselves have an addiction, and they are selling drugs to feed their addiction. Now, I don't condone drug use or drug sales, but we have to use
the science.
But
as a practical matter.
Yeah. Exactly. And the second matter, too, is that many people don't know that what they're selling is fentanyl. You heard the governor talk about how fentanyl is many times stronger than heroin. Very true. Fentanyl is now being mixed in with heroin, cocaine, and other substances, but the individual selling may not know that that's the case. And so it's important for us to take a public health approach. And the one most significant gap that I see in Baltimore, in Maryland, is that we are nowhere near capacity when it comes to getting treatment for people at the time that they need. Only 1 in 10 people with the disease of addiction can get the help that they need. And we're also not targeting these resources to areas of greatest need. And so the $50 million by the governor, I hope, will be targeted to areas that are the most heavily affected, including Baltimore City, which only makes sense because if you want to move the needle in Maryland, you also have to target the areas that are the most heavily affected across the state, and target those areas using evidence-based, proven strategies that work.
It's the Midday Health Watch. My guest, Dr. Lena Nguyen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. 410-662-8780 is our number. midday@wipr.org is our email, and @MiddayTomHall is our Twitter handle. Let's go to the phones. Marsha in Pikesville, you'd like to talk to Dr. Nguyen, I guess, a little bit more about the ACA. Welcome to the show.
My question has to do with buying into Medicare. One idea as to helping the exchanges was to allow people who live in areas where there are no private insurers willing to be on the exchange, or there might be only one and there's no competition, allowing those people to buy into Medicare. It's sort of like the public option. I want to know if Dr. Nguyen knows of any studies that have been done as to how this would affect the coverage of people in those, at least in those areas, and also if any studies have been done with regard to the cost of this to the public.
Well, thanks for your call, Marsha. I appreciate it. Buying into Medicare, I mean, we've heard about Medicare for All as an option that doesn't seem to have much political future, but is there any data about what would happen if people could actually just purchase their own Medicare?
When the ACA was first being proposed, there was a part about the public option, which I think is what Marsha is mentioning about so that there is going to be competition, so that individuals can opt into that public option. That, though, was not politically feasible at the time, and certainly is unlikely to be politically feasible now. Although, if it's something that the president and Speaker Ryan wish to address, I'm sure it's something that that will have the support of many patient advocacy groups, as it has been shown in studies to lower cost and increase coverage. I do want to mention that Medicare, there is misunderstanding, not by Marsha, but just in general, there's misunderstanding about what Medicare covers and doesn't cover. And actually, Medicaid is also used to cover many services that people assume to be under Medicare. Many low-income seniors, for example, receive significant subsidies through Medicaid for their coverage. Medicaid, for example, would cover things including prescription glasses and hearing aids and medications and many things in nursing home care and many other things that would have been threatened would have been almost entirely eliminated if it weren't for the fact that the replacement plan has not gone through.
And just to remind folks, because there are folks that talk to me a lot and seem to be confused about the difference between Medicaid and Medicare. Medicare kicks in when you're 65 years old. That is a program for older Americans. Medicaid kicks in when there is a dire need. Is that a decent way of delineating the two?
I think that's the high level way of thinking about it. I'd say that Medicaid provides for many services. Medicaid provides for, in our city, it provides for a substantial number of pregnant women, of children. We're talking nearly half of pregnant women and children. It provides for individuals with disabilities, and Medicaid expansions in states across the country has provided for healthcare coverage for millions and millions of individuals who would otherwise not have health insurance.
And we talked about Governor Hogan's efforts and others in the legislature addressing the opioid epidemic. Medicaid plays a very crucial role in that. In that very specific, particular health emergency, does it not?
Absolutely. So, that even just the simple statistic that one in four people who receives treatment for substance use disorders gets it through Medicaid, which is millions of people whose lives would be immediately in jeopardy if that Medicaid were to be taken away.
410-662-8780 is the number to call to join Dr. Lena Nguyen, the Baltimore City Health Commissioner, here on the Midday Health Watch. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, we're at Midday Tom Hall. Here's a message come to us via email. Wants to remind us that the history of Obamacare is that it was modeled after Mitt Romney's statewide program in Massachusetts when he was the governor. The concept was initiated and pushed by the Heritage Foundation. They've been much in the news. They're the ones behind the budget proposal, the broad outlines in Mr. Trump's most recent budget suggestion. Obama fought tooth and nail to get what he could with Republicans in the House and Senate. Interesting that she's reminding us that this was, in fact, based on a statewide program in Massachusetts that seems, by all reports, to be working pretty well, actually. Here's Tim sending us an email. Would Dr. Nguyen comment on the GOP hypocrisy of cutting risk corridor payments and then complaining about insurance companies losing money? So there's a bit of a loaded question for you. I think it's pretty clear where Tim's political alliances lie. But risk corridor payments, what are those and how do they affect bottom lines for insurance companies?
I think your two comments just now are tied, or the two emails that they received are very closely tied together, because when I look at my practice in the emergency department, this is what I see. Patient could wait 2 weeks before they seek care. And by the time they seek care, they are extremely ill. Maybe they didn't take their high blood pressure medications and because they ran out of money. And by the time they came in, they had a hemorrhage in their brain from such high blood pressure. Maybe this patient waited and let a small infection that could have been treated by oral antibiotics fester so much so that they now have to get their leg amputated. I mean, this is what I see every day in the ER. Actually, this is what I saw every day in the ER prior to the ACA passing, because people were making these trade-offs that not only were bad for their health, but also end up costing society a lot of money. And so if the Republicans and people in general want to do something that saves money and want to say fiscal responsibility is our number one priority, then we should invest in prevention. Part of the ACA covers a fund called the Prevention and Public Health Fund, which is about 1/7 of the entire CDC budget. And within the last 7 years, it's provided $88 million to Maryland. And that amount allows us to prepare for outbreaks. It allows us to prepare for high blood pressure, to respond to the obesity epidemic, to stop diabetes, to stop smoking. I mean, this is actually what we need to do to shift the cost from this higher cost care to prevention. And this is the concept of that the second person mentioned too, that if we are really focused on reducing cost, then we should be shifting that cost as early, as upstream as we can.
So there is a way of approaching this from a public health perspective that does accomplish cost savings as well.
That's right.
But that doesn't seem to be the conversation in Washington. Didn't seem to be the conversation back in 2008 either. It's interesting how the medical professionals with whom I speak talk about it from a public health perspective. But the politicians are not talking about it from that. It's interesting. We got to take a break. We will come back and have more on that. I am certain. Dr. Lena Nguyen, she is the health commissioner of Baltimore City. She joins us every month for the Midday Health Watch. We will be back after a short break for more conversation with Dr. Nguyen. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Dr. Lena Nguyen. She stops by once a month for the Health Watch. She is, of course, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. If you've got a question or a comment for Dr. Nguyen, 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. A couple of other things, Lena, I want to ask you about, and then we'll try to go back to the phones if we can. The first is Safe Streets. That's a program, a violence intervention program, yes, that falls under the bailiwick of the health department here in Baltimore. A man named Terrell Allen, he's 43 years old. He's been charged with distribution and possession with intent to distribute drugs. It looks like he was sort of running a drug organization, and he was an employee of Safe Streets. This is not the first time that something like this has happened in this program. You want to comment on what's going on over there with that program?
Sure. I first want to explain what Safe Streets is. Safe Streets is a violence interruption and violence prevention approach that comes from a public health basis. We strongly believe that violence is a public health issue. It's certainly a health issue when people are dying of gun violence, of interpersonal violence. It's also a public health issue because it's something that spreads from person to person, like other diseases. And so there's a way to stop it, there's a way to prevent it, there's a way to cure it. Safe Streets is our way of interrupting violence when it occurs. Using this approach, it's also a reentry program. The individuals that we hire, the vast majority of them are themselves formerly incarcerated. They are former gang members and drug dealers. They have the credibility of the community. They're credible messengers. I mean, if I were to walk the streets of West Baltimore and to say to somebody, please don't shoot, I'm not sure that anybody would listen to me, versus somebody who has been there, who is seen as a trusted leader in that community, their voice carries a lot of weight. In 1 year, our Safe Streets employees interrupt something like 800 conflicts, the majority of which are found to be likely or very likely to result in gun violence. So we think about the dozens, if not hundreds of lives that these individuals save. That said, every intervention, just like every intervention in medicine, has a side effect. When we employ individuals who are formerly incarcerated, there's always a chance of recidivism. We don't tolerate it. Whenever these charges are brought to our attention, we always cooperate fully with our law enforcement officials. We do monthly background checks for all of our employees. We provide mental health and other training opportunities so that we can identify potential issues before they arise. That said, we do recognize that this is a known side effect. But just like we take medications that have side effects, just because there are side effects does not mean that the intervention itself isn't useful. We stand behind the work of Safe Streets. I personally am so inspired every day hearing the stories of our outreach workers who have really turned around their own lives, who are contributing tremendously to society. And I also think about a program like this, that Safe Streets costs about $2 million a year to run, which sounds like a lot of money, but we think about the number of lives that Safe Streets is saving and the number of families and community members that are impacted. It's important for us to not just think about the cost of an intervention. We have to think about the cost of doing nothing. And we have to recognize that when we employ people from the community, we're also sending a strong message that people are not problems to deal with. They are the solutions to every problem.
And, of course, you talk all the time about the cost of doing nothing, not only people's lives being saved, but then there's an enormous cost taking care of those people who do not die in acts of violence but are severely disabled, paralyzed, spinal injuries, that kind of thing. I mean, we've got to take care of those people for sometimes decades and decades, and it's just a terrible loss all around. So bottom line is, I mean, this isn't the first time, perhaps it won't even be the last time, that one of these violence interrupters experiences recidivism, but you're still behind the program and think it's a good expenditure of the funds.
It will not be the last time. The same way that somebody who is getting chemotherapy for cancer, they will have side effects. Somebody who is getting medications for their high blood pressure will have side effects. These things happen, and that is the way that medical interventions work. We have to always think about not just the side effect that we experience, but the benefit, the cost savings, as well as the lives that are saved. Safe Streets continually faces issues with funding and sustainability, and we continue to look forward to working with our state partners, with our city, our federal partners, to make sure that a program like this that saves so much money down the line. I mean, one homicide costs society $1.2 million. An injury, a gunshot wound that involves the spine, costs at least $500,000. We're talking $2 million for a program that saves dozens, if not hundreds, of these individuals' lives and hundreds of millions of dollars down the line.
And we should note that Mayor Pugh is definitely on record as being a strong supporter of the Safe Streets approach and this program. Let's see if we can sneak in a couple of more calls. Kathy in Havre de Grace, welcome to the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Hi, thank you for talking to me. I appreciate this very much. First-time caller.
Great, thanks.
Doctor, I just had a question about Suboxone and the use of that drug when it comes to helping people get off of the opioid crisis. How do you feel about the use of that drug, and how long would you recommend someone be on something like that?
All right. Thank you for that call, Kathy. So Suboxone, let's explain what Suboxone does and in what circumstances is it administered.
Absolutely, Kathy. Thank you for the question. Let me explain by saying that when somebody is addicted to opioids, they're addicted to heroin, they're addicted to oxycodone, to prescription drugs, that's a disease. It's a chronic brain disease. And we know that there are medical treatments that work. There are three FDA-approved medications for the use of individuals with opioid addiction. Those are methadone, number one. Number two is naltrexone or Vivitrol. And number three that you mentioned is Suboxone, also known as buprenorphine. All three are FDA-approved. All three have been shown to have to work when it comes to treating individuals with addiction. So I absolutely support the use of Suboxone or buprenorphine for individuals with an opioid with an opioid addiction. We need to change, though, our language around what it means to treat somebody with one of these medications. If somebody is getting treated for diabetes, nobody would ever say, well, why have you been on insulin for a year? Isn't it time to wean you off? We would never say that because we accept that diabetes is a chronic disease and medications work and we should be treating people for it. In the same way, there are many people who are in long-term recovery, millions of people around the country in long-term recovery, and many of these individuals will, for years or maybe even their lifetimes, be on medications like Suboxone, buprenorphine, or methadone, or other treatments. That doesn't mean that the treatment is ineffective. It actually means that the treatment is working. And we need to change our language and our understanding to reflect the best available science and evidence.
Yeah, so it's not a matter of getting off Suboxone or Bup. It's a matter of, you know, maintaining functionality and being able to participate in society. If you take a drug to do that, like if you take a drug for high blood pressure or like if you take a drug for high cholesterol, the same thing. Well, thank you for your call, Kathy. I appreciate it. Mary Lou in Towson, welcome to the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a retired nurse practitioner, and my last job was doing a lot of cancer screenings for people who fell through the cracks, made a dollar too much for medical assistance, or couldn't afford insurance. So my last part of my job was just as Obamacare came in. It was wonderful to be able to see these people get insurance because we could do the screening, but they couldn't get the treatment. So then what happened is they would be eligible for the treatment, but they needed dental care. So my major question is, I don't understand why medical assistants will stop paying for dental care when someone turns 18. Do you have any thoughts on that? It's something that we don't hear much about.
Thanks for the call, Mary Lou.
Mary Lou, you are completely right. Working in the emergency department, I am extremely frustrated. I know that all my counterparts are extremely frustrated when we have patients coming in for dental pain, which is extremely painful. I mean, for anyone who has experienced a cavity or an abscess, I mean, it's very painful. We know that these individuals need help, but we also know that the ER is not the best place to have someone's tooth be pulled or to address dental pain. And incidentally, treatment of dental pain, an inappropriate treatment, also leads to opioid addiction as well, because maybe somebody actually needs dental care, but they're in so much pain, and so they end up getting opioids instead. We thankfully have expanded dental coverage to children, and I'm very glad that that is now covered under Medicaid. That only happened, by the way, after the death of a young child who had an abscess that went untreated that then resulted in the child dying. I mean, these are the incidents that prompted even for our children to get something as basic as dental care coverage. But I absolutely agree that it's something that insurers need to offer. It's something that should be seen as essential as any other type of physical health, because frankly, the health of our teeth, the health of our mouth, the health of our dental, or the lack of dental care, significantly impacts physical health and mental health.
One of the divides that was, you know, again brought to the fore just last week when this vote was going to happen and then didn't happen, has to do with this notion of healthcare as a responsibility or as a right. And there are people who voted against this bill because there were Republicans who would have voted against this bill had it come to the floor because they thought it didn't demand enough personal responsibility. You know, I talked to – I have a friend who's an intensive care physician, and he talks about a patient who has come in three or four times in the ICU because she's not taking her diabetes medicine. She's just refusing to take it. And so here he's treating her in this very extreme circumstance at great expense to the hospital, and, you know, ergo to the taxpayers. How do you respond to folks who say, look, it's a choice. You can either insure yourself or not. Take your chances. And it's a responsibility to essentially be healthy so that you don't jack up the rates for everybody else.
I'd say three things. The first is that we wouldn't turn away this person that you mentioned who is very ill and needs ICU care. We would treat them in the ICU. Isn't it a lot cheaper if we give the person the medications that they need in the first place, maybe find out why they're not taking medications? I found out, for example, some of my patients are not taking medications because they can't afford them. They may not be taking them because they can't read the label. Maybe they are not taking them because they lack transportation to get them. We're going to end up paying for it in some way. Let's pay for it up front. The second thing is that the rhetoric of choice doesn't work when that choice is predicated on privilege. I can tell my patients all day long that they need to eat better foods. But if they live in a food desert where they have to take two buses and walk 25 blocks to get healthy groceries, what good am I doing them? Or if we're talking about a child, what choice does that child have to be born into a situation where they may be the subject of, they may be the victim of abuse and neglect and other problems? Isn't it our responsibility to make sure that that child has the best available options? And I'd say third and finally, there's something to be said about what is the responsibility of society. It's not just an individual responsibility. We also have the responsibility of society to not talk about politics and talking points, but to focus on people and the future of our society.
To end on a very positive note, the health department announced earlier this month that the 1,000th pair of glasses was distributed to kids under the Vision for Baltimore program. So at least we've got that to latch onto and smile as we finish up our Health Watch. We will see you next month. Thanks so much, Dr. Nguyen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, she's the health commissioner of Baltimore City. This has been another installment of the Midday Health Watch. We've got a link to more information at wypr.org/health. Midday. I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. They serve coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Tomorrow on Midday, business innovation expert and author Alec Ross joins me to explore some of the revolutionary advances and challenges that lie ahead for global industries over the next decade and what that means for everybody else. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your being with us today. Have a great day.